we are, again, turning our hearts toward Philippians chapter 4. I want to tell you before we jump into the text today that I identify with the text today, because in our text today we have two people that Paul calls out by name in front of the entire church. I'm a PK, preacher's kid, so I can tell you that on more than one occasion in my life, my name has been called from the stage by my father to get onto me during a church service. Like from the stage, "Devin, straighten up. Devin, what are you doing?" This has happened to me on more than one occasion. It's not as bad, though, as one of my best friends growing up. One of my favorite stories about being called out in church was him. His dad was kind of this funny guy that was a delight to be around. But my buddy's name is Ron Davis. Ronald was his name growing up. And his dad was Ronnie Davis. And one Sunday, Ronnie was going to get on to Ronald, who was, I don't know, two or three pews up in front of him, and he was cutting up. Again, he was just a kid. And Ronnie was going to call Ronald by name, and he was just going to say, "Ronald." But instead, it came out like 20 volumes too high. So it was like, "Ronald." And they just like got this look on his face to the point the pastor had to stop the sermon and just look over, and everybody was just laughing. So because he got called out in church in a louder than intended way. So I can always hear that in my mind. "Ronald!" Whoa, that was way too loud. So Paul calls out two people in church. He calls two people by name. Their names were Euodia and Syntyche. So I don't know how that would have come out exactly. Syntyche! But anyways, these two ladies get called out, and the sad thing is we're still talking about it 2,000 years later. Every time I've been called out in church, it was momentary. We had a discussion about it after church. If it was funny, we might still talk about it at some family gatherings, but I don't think we're going to be talking about it 2,000 years from now, but we're still talking about this story 2,000 years later. So Paul's ending his letter to this group of Jesus followers who are in the Roman colony of Philippi. And as he approaches the end of his letter, as with many of his letters, he kind of switches tones, and he kind of has this warm tone of a friend that is talking to a church that he loves. Now, remember, as we hold the book of Philippians in our hands and all of the letters that Paul and others wrote, we are holding literal letters that were written to people. And so, remember, this is obviously the day and age before texting or the ability to email or the ability to make a phone call. And so the way that they communicated was with personal letters. And so you would expect in a letter that Paul is writing to an individual group in a local city that it makes perfect sense that his letter will contain personal sentiments and personal instructions in his letter that we still hold 2,000 years later. And so let's jump into chapter 4. This verse actually probably would go better at the end of chapter 3. But it's kind of a summary verse from what we were talking about last week. Paul says, "Therefore," and anytime we see that in the text, it's pointing us back to the things we've just been talking about. Paul says, "Therefore, in light of what we've been talking about, my brothers, whom I love and long for, my joy and crown," and then here's his instructions based on what they've just been talking about, "stand firm thus in the Lord, my beloved." So this word "therefore" means that Paul's kind of bringing things to a close. In light of what we've just been talking about, and if we go into kind of the bigger context of what Paul's been talking about all the way back to chapter 1, Paul was reminding us to conduct ourselves in a manner that's worthy of the gospel. So Paul says, in light of the fact that I'm instructing you to conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel, I've been telling you to live in unity, right? Last week, I've been telling you to run this race with faithfulness, pressing ahead, looking forward and not back. I've told you, if we jump right back into the previous verses, to live your life knowing your primary citizenship is in heaven. Live like heavenly citizens. Paul says, in light of all these things, therefore, stand firm. Be steadfast. Now, notice the affection that Paul uses in this verse. He says, my brothers, so there's a family feel, right? They're part of the family of faith. He says, whom I love and long for. There's this desire of Paul to be with them. He calls them his joy and his crown. Basically what that means is Paul saying, my life is better because of you. You're my joy, you're my crown. My life is better off because I know you and I do ministry with you, Paul's saying. So clearly there's this strong tie that exists between Paul and these believers at the church of Philippi. And he says, in light of all these things, stand firm. There's this call of steadfastness, like stand together, be united, be unified in the Lord, Paul says. And again, this is a great reminder for us as a local gathering of believers. We are better together. We are stronger when we are unified around the gospel, around the message of Jesus. In light of his call to unity, stand firm, be steadfast, be unified, conduct yourselves in a way worthy of the gospel. Paul says, now let me break that down for you, what that means in your local congregation. Verse 2. I entreat, this is a strong word that means to beg, to long for. I entreat, Euodia, and I entreat, so double entreat here. I entreat, Syntyche, to agree in the Lord. Yes, I ask you also, true companion, help these women who have labored side by side with me in the gospel together with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. So Paul implores these two quarreling ladies to work out their differences. Now, as I am preaching on Sundays, part of preaching is establishing eye contact and trying to connect with your audience. How many of you, as I have been preaching at different times, felt like at some point Devin was looking straight at me? Go ahead and put your hand up. Okay. Most of the time, my eyesight tends to fall right here. Maybe I need to be more conscious of preaching to the McGillicks or my own wife. So some of you have felt that way. I can tell you while I'm preaching, I never intentionally look at anyone. My goal is to finally try to establish some type of eye contact throughout the room, throughout the message. But there's never a point in my mind where I think I really need to drill down and look at this person in this moment. But all of us, when we have been sitting in an audience and hearing someone preach or speak, it felt like the preacher was, or speaker was looking right at me. I'm not even going to ask like how many of you felt like I was preaching to you, but just the looking at you factor, okay? If you don't want to ever feel like I'm ever looking at you, then you probably don't need to sit in this vicinity. You're going to get it if you're in this room, okay? But in this, Paul is like looking directly at him, right? He's like, I'm preaching to you, Dave Ward, right? He's calling them by name. It's not just a general eyesight thing. Paul says, I am looking at you, Euodia and Syntyche, like, work it out. Now, we don't know the source of conflict between these two ladies. I have heard that it was whether it should be called stuffing or dressing. I heard that was the point of contention, like big Thanksgiving meal at the local church, and one of them was like, I'm bringing stuffing. And the other person's like, stuffing? What, are you from New York City? There's no such thing as stuffing. It's dressing. No amens at all. How many of you eat stuffing? How many of you eat dressing? Okay. So you can see this is a point of contention. To the point Paul has to call it out in the book of Philippians. That's not in the text. Like, don't tell anybody that. But Paul is calling out this conflict that we don't know the source of the conflict. Here's what we do know. Both these ladies are followers of Jesus, the text says. Both of them are gospel people. Paul says, you have labored with me in the gospel. Both of them are co-laborers in the church serving together. Both of them have served alongside Paul and other church leaders. He calls out one church leader by name, Clement, and his wife Clementine. Paul names these church leaders. He said, you've served alongside us. Here's what Paul says. Based on what unites you, you're both in the Lord. You're both gospel people. You're both servants of Jesus. Based on what unites you, figure it out. Paul even says, if we need to bring in a third party, we'll do that. Now, we translate it in the ESV that I was reading from. It translates it true companion. One of the translations that can be here is the loyal yoke fellow. That's the translation of the word, the loyal yoke fellow. So what that means is, like, this is a guy that brought unity in the church, that when there was disagreements, that they had people that were unifying people. They that would be even brought into situations to help them work it out if necessary. Every church needs some good yoke fellows that can bring people together and unify. Now, let's just be really frank when we're reading this text and break it down for local churches. Relational conflict happens. It happens. Relational conflict happens, period. And according to this text, people who love Jesus, people who love the gospel, people who serve alongside each other can have conflicts. You know why? Because we are human. We have different opinions. Even as followers of Jesus, we want our way, don't we? And we see it here. People who genuinely love Jesus, who are caring about the church, serving in the church, served alongside Paul, they are in disagreement. And when conflict happens in the life of a local gathering of believers, we are urged to remember what unites us and to seek unity because we follow Jesus. That's what unites us. We follow Jesus. So Paul says, you love Jesus, you're about the gospel, figure it out. Now, I have been in some situations where I questioned whether one of the parties loved Jesus. But I can tell you, for the most part, when there were sincere believers that loved Jesus, cared about the gospel, that they would find a way to figure it out, even if it meant that they would agree to disagree. That's why we talk about closed-handed issues and open-handed issues and center circle issues and third circle issues, because we're not going to allow those second and third circle issues, those open-hand issues, to be things that create division in the local body. We'll agree to disagree on some stuff and be okay with that, right? And we see that displayed here. We see that it's okay at times to disagree. We have a group of elders that help lead City Church that we don't always agree on everything. There's times that we agree to disagree. You know what we do agree on? The gospel. You know what we do agree on? That City Church needs to be about Jesus. And because those are the things that hold us together. And so, if we were to bring the elders up here and have a conversation, they would say, like, there's times that Evan is just hard-headed on stuff. But it's just like, we agree to... Have you guys ever met our former elder, Rick Marshall? I'm on the stage, dude. Remember that. It's like, I always have the final word. Rick Marshall, agree in the Lord. Eodius. What was I talking about? Most conflict, church, family, relationship, most conflict stems from control issues. I want my way. I'm right. You're wrong, right? In the broader context of Paul's letter here, we are called to an others-first, servant-oriented mindset. Paul calls it the mindset of Jesus, putting the interest of other people ahead of my own. Because most conflict happens because we want to be in control. We want our decision to be made. We want our way to happen, and it creates conflict, right? And Paul calls us in this letter to say, be a servant-minded person like Jesus was. Be others-focused before you are me-focused. And when you do that, it creates unity and limits division, even though division will happen because we are humans and sinners. So what a great lesson here in this text about learning to be able to get along. One of the beautiful realities of the body of Christ is the diversity of the body of Christ. But because there is diversity, there will be conflict. Opinions differ, feelings get hurt, people get upset, angry, jealous, disgruntled, right? We disagree at times. And when these moments occur, we are challenged by Paul. Agree in the Lord. Remember what binds you together. In essential beliefs, we emphasize unity. In non-essential beliefs, we exercise liberty. And in all matters, we exhibit grace. At this point, Paul transitions in the text to some very short and intentional everyday life instruction. So let's break down Paul's kind of final admonitions as we head toward the end of the text. Verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Paul says rejoice always. And if you missed it the first time, rejoice in the Lord always. Repeats himself. Two times he gives it to us. Rejoice. Again, we've said throughout the series, joy is one of the primary themes of this letter. Remember, being written from prison, chained to a Roman guard, awaiting his verdict of life or death, writing to a group of Jesus followers who are facing severe persecution and suffering. Paul says, rejoice always in the Lord. Rejoice always. Again, I say, rejoice. Our joy is found in the Lord. And that means there is no circumstance outside of his control. That joy is available and joy is constant when we are in the Lord, even in the face of whatever it is that we are facing at the time. Rejoice in the Lord always. Not like when you feel like it, not when you're having a good day. Paul's like, when you are grounded in the Lord, he is the source of your joy, regardless of the adverse circumstances you might be facing. Did you know rejoicing always only makes sense when your joy is grounded in who God is and not in your life circumstances? It only makes sense to rejoice always when your joy is dependent upon someone bigger than you and bigger than your circumstances. This makes no sense otherwise. That's why I have told you that to adopt an attitude of joyful living is dangerous. It's dangerous for you. It's dangerous to have the attitude, no matter what is going on in my life, I'm going to find my joy in the Lord. It's dangerous to have the mindset of, God, I understand I'm in a season right now. And my temptation is to be disgruntled. My temptation is to be down and defeated. But I'm not going to do that because I know you're in control. I'm telling you, it's a dangerous way to live life, that no matter what happens, I'm going to find joy in the Lord. It's dangerous, but there is security, right? There is security and groundedness as we find ourselves centered in the gospel of who God is and not in our life circumstances. The reason it is dangerous is because there is going to be times in life that you have to look at the difficulties of the circumstances that you're going through and say, it's okay. God's in control. And that is a dangerous way to live life. That no matter what happens to me, I'm going to rest in God. Verse 5. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. Now, this word reasonableness is translated that way in the ESV, is also translated gentleness in other translations. And Paul says this is to be known to everyone. This is kind of a difficult word for us to translate into English. It does carry the idea, ever how it's translated, of selflessness, that we are to live selfless, do not live life focused on our own rights, that we are to strive for a reputation that is marked by selflessness, by gentleness. As we grow in our knowledge and understanding of the gospel, as we cling to Jesus, as we recognize the abundance of grace, we become less selfish and we become more gentle, considering others more significant than myself, Paul said earlier in his letter. Look at the last part. I want to spend a little more time in this next instruction, the end of verse 5. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. So Paul's third directive, right? Rejoice in the Lord always. Let your selflessness, your gentleness be known to all people everywhere. His third directive is prefaced with this little reminder, God is near. In light of what I'm about to say, in light of the instructions I'm about to give, in light of the command that I'm about to lay on you, Paul says, remember, I'm prefacing this with God is close. God is near. God is not removed. God is not occupied. God is not busy. God is not distant. God is close at hand. And because God is near, do not be anxious, Paul says. Because God is close at hand, we are instructed not to be anxious. This word anxious means to be unduly concerned about something. The implication here is anxiety and worry and angst is a failure in the moment that I'm worrying, in the moment that I am experiencing it. In the moment, it is a failure to acknowledge God's closeness, God's nearness. Right now, in this moment, I am acting as if God is not close by. I'm acting as if God is not near me right now. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious. Now, we're going to break this down in a moment because it's complicated. But to illustrate this, right, if Levi is a toddler or any young child, let's just use a common analogy as a parent. If you're helping your child learn to do something, we'll just use ride a bike. When you are teaching your child to ride a bike without training wheels, when you initially begin to teach a child to ride a bike, you want to stay very close to them. It's not just like, good luck with this, right? Oh, I forgot the helmet. It's initially you want to hold on to the back of the bike. You want to keep them stable. You want to keep them pointed in the right direction before you, you know, release them into the wild on a bike for the first time, pedaling. Levi is... We got a pretty big bike with training wheels, and what I've learned is there's going to be a learning curve for him because with the training wheels, his turns can be basically 90-degree turns, right? He's going and just like, I'm going this way, I'm going this way. Man, when those training wheels come off, he is in for the ride of his life. But when he's learning, right, I'm near, I'm close. Daddy is close to you. You don't have to be afraid right now because Daddy's close. Daddy's holding on to you. Daddy is near you right now. You don't have to ride the bike as if I'm not here because I'm here and I'm holding on. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious. Now, let's talk again openly. I understand firsthand in the Hudson family how complicated anxiety and depression can be. Paul referred last week that we are still lowly in our bodies, that one day we will have a body that is like his. Until then, we live in lowly, is the phrase he uses, lowly, broken bodies. And so I understand that these struggles can be as much physical at times as mental or emotional or spiritual. That there are physical things that can be happening in someone's body that creates anxiety and depression. We have lived this in our family firsthand. We have understood that there are times that as the physical part of it can be addressed with medicine, like we would address any other thing, that that's not a lack of faith in those moments. So we get like this is a complicated issue. It's complicated. You know when it's even more complicated? When you do not deal with it personally. Okay? Several people in the Hudson family deal with this. Devin is not one of them at this point in his life. So it's hard for me to often have empathy or to sympathize with those in the family that do. Because for me, it's like, well, just get over it, right? So it becomes complicated when you do not experience it firsthand. And so we enter a text like this with an awareness that we live in lowly bodies. Here is what I have learned when dealing with this in our family, even with my older kids at times. I do not know, and as a pastor, I do not know a single person who battles anxiety or depression who wants to battle it. I don't know a single person that goes through it's like, yeah, sign me up for that. Sign me up for feeling despondent, right? Questioning whether I should be around. Like, sign me up for that. That sounds awesome. Like, nobody wants to battle with it. No one wants to struggle with it. And if you don't enter the conversation from that perspective, you're missing it. That the people who are wrestling with this is a reality to them. So I know that feelings of anxiety can often be as much about being anxious over being anxious as it is about circumstances. So it's okay to talk about this and say, we live in lowly bodies, we live in broken bodies, and we have to be, at times, there has to be intervention, right? Just like there's intervention in other things that may require medical assistance or things like that to help, or counseling, or whatever it may be, to help in these situations. And yet, with that in mind, Paul directs us here to remember that God is near. And if he is near, there is no reason to be anxious. Jesus speaks about anxiety in the Sermon on the Mount. And in that sermon, he discusses some of the most common causes of anxiety. He talks about physical attributes. How am I being perceived by others? How do others look at me? What do others think about me? I mean, is that a source of anxiety in 2020, in our social media-driven day and age? Like, how consumed are we with the perspective of other people about us? Jesus also talks about clothing. And what he means by clothing is not necessarily the pants and shirt that you're wearing. He's really talking about what we have and do not have that creates anxiety in our lives. He talks about the essentials of life, food and drink. What he's talking about there is, how am I going to provide? How am I going to provide for my family? Is my job safe? Is there security? Is there financial security in my life? Is this a subject that creates anxiety? Absolutely. Stuff that we still deal with today. He also talks about the future in the Sermon on the Mount. These are things that I can't control. Things that are around the corner for me, that I worry about, that I'm concerned about, that I'm thinking about, that dominate my thoughts. So how relevant is it that Paul's talking about this, building on the words of Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount? And in both contexts, both Jesus and Paul say, hey, God is close. God is close. Like Jesus, Paul proposes an antidote for anxiety. We read it. Paul says, pray. Prayer. Instead of worrying, Paul says, we are to make our request known to God. Talk to God about it. Talk to God about it because he is near and he is really big. So talk to him about it. And in this text, Paul emphasizes thankfulness. That when we focus our attention on the provision of this big and near God, that it diminishes the things in our life that generate anxiety. If we put it in the context of Jesus' words, when we are focused on the bigness and the provision of God, and by the way, that's what Jesus does. Jesus says, why are you consumed with what you do not have? Why are you consumed about how you're going to provide the essentials of life? Have you not seen the birds of the air? Have you not seen the flowers of the field? How much more important are you to God than a bird or the flowers of the field, Jesus says. He puts it in context for us to understand the bigness of God and the nearness of God. So Paul says when we focus our attention on the provision of God, it diminishes the things in our life that tend to generate anxiety. And so we learn to live with an attitude of gratitude. Did you know that that requires intentionality, doesn't it? That I will be intentional to be thankful. To recognize the things that God has provided. And notice this beautiful promise that Paul gives in verse 7. When we do this, when we talk to God about it, when we recognize the nearness and bigness of God and the peace of God, right? This is divinely provided supernatural peace. The peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. I like the proactive language that Paul uses here, that the peace of God will guard your heart. As we give our anxieties and worries to God in prayer, the peace of God, right? It's his peace, divine peace, which goes beyond human comprehension, Paul says, like the human mind cannot fathom it. Put this in context. It doesn't make human sense to be peaceful in the middle of chaos. That doesn't make sense from a human perspective. When chaos is happening, in our human perspective, that's the time to be anxious. That's the time to be concerned. That's the time to be worried when that stuff's going on in your life. And so Paul says this supernatural divine peace is beyond human comprehension. It doesn't even make sense to function, to live life this way. It doesn't fit in normal human categories, Paul says. This peace will stand guard over our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. I like this phrase of standing guard over our hearts and minds. Again, Roman colony, right? Roman citizens, they were accustomed to seeing Roman guards. And so Paul uses this analogy of the peace of God standing as this kind of garrison of guards protecting. Protecting the city is what would have come to their minds. I like to use this as a mental visual for me when I have those moments where I'm struggling with anxiety or worry or concern. I like to have the visual that it is the peace of God that stands guard over my heart and mind. And I'll pray that, I will say that, right? I will visualize that the peace of God is standing guard over my heart and my mind. So whatever it is that looks like a soldier protecting something in your mind, you take that image and you put peace of God on the breastplate of that soldier, you put it on their chest, you put it on their uniform, and you make your army as big as you need it to be. Some of you are one soldier people. You just feel like, I just need the one soldier standing guard. Some of you are like battalion people. Some of you are like entire, right, Marines people. I need the whole branch of army. I need the whole branch of the Marines standing around me. Whatever it is for you, you take that image, peace of God, and you recognize God's peace is standing guard over my mind, standing guard over my heart. Doesn't mean concern's not going to creep through. Doesn't mean worry's not going to happen. Not going to mean that there's physical things that cause anxiety. But at the end of the day, I have to have the image as a follower of Jesus that the peace of God standing guard over my heart and mind. I'm going to give it to Him. I'm going to pray. I'm going to talk to God about it. My instinct is going to be to talk to God first because He's near. Prayerful people are peaceful people. Prayerful people are peaceful people. You know why? Because God's peace stands guard over their hearts and minds. Peace amid chaos. Think about it. Paul's writing to people who are suffering. They're being persecuted. And Paul speaks of a peace that is bigger than the chaos, that doesn't fit in normal human categories. And yet Paul speaks of a peace that transcends life circumstances because it is grounded in the bigness and nearness of God. So hear me closely. We are not dismissing the reality of the deep levels of anxiety and depression with which people deal. I have been in situations where the answer was just pray it away. And I can tell you that is not the solution that the person that is hearing that wants to hear again. They have heard it over and over and over. They don't want to hear it again. They don't want to feel spiritually defeated because they can't pray it away. That's not the solution. They do not want to feel anxious. They have prayed for peace. But what I am encouraging based on this text is that we have to put into practice intentional prayer. Here's what I know. Identifying and reminding myself of the bigness and nearness of God through consistent prayer and having an intentional attitude of gratitude helps address the issue of anxiety. It helps deal with it. No matter what level you are or are not experiencing, what I know from this text is recognizing and identifying the bigness of God, the nearness of God, and having a spirit of gratitude regardless of what's going on helps deal with it. It may not take it away completely, but it will help you deal with it. Some struggle more deeply than others because we live in lowly bodies. But I can tell you, whether you deal with it at high levels or low levels, prayer makes a difference. So be intentional. Be intentional to pray, to have an attitude. Pray specific prayers to God. Be near to me. Prayers of thanksgiving, prayers of supplication, Paul says. Prayers asking God for his peace to stand guard over your heart and mind. Do not be anxious, Paul says. Instead, talk to God about it. Does it mean it will go completely away? May or may not. But what I can tell you is it will bend your heart toward God. It will make you more spiritually healthy at some level to bend your heart toward God. Okay? Complicated. Don't have it all figured out. But from this text, we know, right, intentionality with our gratitude and giving it to God, praying, directing it to God, at least helps shape our heart and mind with the peace of God. So speaking of holding our thoughts captive through prayer, Paul now provides us this list upon things which to focus our minds. Verse 8, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Instead of being anxious and worrying, Paul says, focus, think about things that are true, things that are honorable, that means worthy of respect, things that are righteous, they're just, things that are pure, that are holy, clean. Don't be filling your mind with impure things, Paul says. Think about things that are lovely, that point us toward the love of God for us and the love of God for other people. Things that are commendable, this is the idea of being admirable. Things that are excellent, praiseworthy. They are worthy of praising God. Here's Paul's primary emphasis. Focus on the things in life that are worth focusing on. Look for the virtuous all around you and focus your attention on these things. Paul says, focus on the virtuous things in life. The things that are worth your attention. Focus on those things. The things that are good, that are creating life in you, that are pointing you in the right direction. His list is not like, hey, every negative thing you can find in life, focus on it. Things that are extremely sinful and impure, get your mind set on those things, right? No, he says the opposite. Don't focus on the things that are negative. Don't focus on the things that tear down. Focus on the things that are building up, that are life giving. Paul says, direct your attention. And so, can you imagine what a difference it would make in our thought life and our attitude in life if we just put this principle into practice? What am I thinking about? What am I thinking about? And then Paul puts the gospel into practice. And this is our last verse for today, verse 9. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, here's our word, practice these things. And, bookends, right? And the God of peace will be with you. There it is again. The God of peace will be with you. Paul says, cultivate proper Christ-like behavior patterns. And he says here, you've learned it from others. Paul says, you've seen it in me. You've learned it from other people. This gospel message has been passed down to you, right? He says, others have taught it to you, and you have received it. In other words, the faith has been passed to you. So take the things that you have been taught and you have received and practice them. Cultivate them in your life. So here's kind of the summary of verses kind of 6 down. When anxiety surfaces, and before, you don't have to wait till it happens. When anxiety surfaces, talk to God about it. Exercise thankful praying. And then these last two verses. Life tends to be disorderly. So exercise mental discipline and practical discipline. Exercise mental discipline with your mind and practical discipline with your life. So I want to end today with just these words of encouragement. I want you to hear from me today, regardless of where you're at in life, no matter what's going on in your life, if you are a follower of Jesus, God is near. He is close. He is not distant. He is not removed. He understands. The Hebrew writer says that Jesus understands at our deepest levels what we go through as humans. He gets it. Whatever you're experiencing, emotionally, physically, spiritually, mentally, God is near. He is close at hand. Even when he does not feel near, even when he seems removed, he is close. He is near. The rest of that story is this. He is also sovereign. He is big. He is merciful. Listen to this. The entire world, the entire universe, right? Everything we know, as far as you can stretch your mind, the entire world, the entire universe, the entire solar system, the entire everything belongs to God. Therefore, you belong to God. He's that big, and you are his. Even down to your circumstances. He is near. He is big. He is merciful. And I want you to hear me say this. Jesus has done absolutely everything necessary for you to live out your faith in your thoughts and in your actions. He has done everything necessary. He has provided the way for you to live out your faith in your thoughts and in your actions. This is not about, right, I'm good enough, I measure up, I'm going to do better, I'm going to look in the mirror 10 times a day and tell myself how awesome I am. This is about resting in Jesus, talking to Jesus, bring your anxieties and worries to him, and the promise is if we will rest in him, if we will focus our lives in the Lord, in Christ, that his peace will stand guard over your heart and your mind. That his peace will stand guard over your soul. So that we may say, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say, rejoice.